kick off. So, we've called this course Consciousness Unfolds, and I want to explore, or start to explore, what Buddhism has to say about the nature of consciousness or the nature of mind. I might use the two terms interchangeably. And what we heard from, Sukha City read some verses in the first half, just at the end of the meditation, just before the tea break. We heard these two verses from the Dhammapada, which is one of the oldest texts in the Buddhist canon. And the first two verses, I'm going to read them again, the first two verses of this, possibly the oldest or one of the oldest texts, talk about the importance of the mind, the primacy of the mind. So the first two verses are, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. The second verse. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. So, I just want to draw attention to the fact that the Dhammapada, one of perhaps the best known and one of the earliest works of the Buddhist scriptures, if it begins with these two verses about the nature of experience being produced by mind, led by mind, then mind is an essential concept, if you like, in Buddhism. In a way, you could say that the whole of the Buddhist life is about liberating the mind by, in a way, purifying it and by understanding the delusion that limits us from experiencing mind as it really is. So consciousness or mind is given primary importance in Buddhism. Without working on our own mind, there's no spiritual development. There's no Dharma life. We could be kind and altruistic as we like. On its own, that doesn't necessarily lead to a liberated mind. Although, as the Dhammapada says, if you act with a pure mind, then it does tend to lead to a happier state of mind. And of course, vice versa. And we're going to come on to that a bit later. So in this 5 weeks, I want to explore what Buddhism has to say about the nature of mind or the nature of consciousness. I'm not going to do it exhaustively. The Buddhist tradition is vast and different schools of Buddhism have different teachings. So the Dhammapada is early Buddhism and it's very, very practical. And then later Buddhism can become very abstract, even sort of seemingly philosophical, although actually even the sort of very abstract models, and we might look at one or two, have a really practical purpose. They're about how do you liberate the mind, how do you gain enlightenment, how do you work with experience. But one of the problems about talking about consciousness or mind is that as soon as you talk about it, as soon as you even say the word consciousness or mind, you falsify it. As soon as you refer to it, I've turned it into an object in a world of other objects, as if consciousness were a thing or mind were a thing, like a book is a thing. And you know, a cushion is a thing, or whatever it is, all these objects that surround us. As soon as we label it and treat it as a noun, one can't help think it's an object in a world of other objects. But consciousness isn't like that. Consciousness isn't a thing. It's not in the same category as things. Consciousness is, you could say, it's the subjective dimension of experience. But it isn't a thing. It's what allows experience to happen, to be experienced. It is, it's the sort of, it's a bit like light being shone on something so that you, it illumines the object. The light of awareness illumines experience. It allows experience. But it itself isn't a thing. Yeah? And what's more, you can't ever sort of experience consciousness directly. You can't say, just like I can see a book, can I go inward and see my own mind? Because mind is the thing that does the seeing. And you can't turn it around to look at itself. So that would be like, you know, a knife trying to cut itself or something. You can't turn it around and experience it directly. So on the one hand, it's not a thing. On the other hand, it's not something that can be experienced directly, because it is what allows experience to happen. It's the framework within which experience takes place. It's not a thing that can become part of that framework. So in a sense, it's impossible to talk about, because all of our language, all the words we use, refer indirectly or directly to a world of things. There's nothing in the world that refers to consciousness. There's nothing that you can point to as a correlate of consciousness. So to give it a word falsifies it immediately. But nevertheless, we need to talk about it. If we're going to understand what's going on in experience, we need to talk about it. We need to talk about this phenomena that we call consciousness. So I'm going to attempt to talk about it over the next few weeks, using some traditional models, but also just talking about my own experience, and maybe we can share something of that, and you can ask questions and things. So we'll treat it a little bit like I'll pause every so often and see if we if you have any questions. So this week, what I want to start off with, though, is looking at a basic sort of, you could say, underlying view that Buddhism says is the nature of things. And it also is the view that all unenlightened beings, so that includes me, and as I say, hopefully all of you, if you are enlightened, well done. But I'm leading this course, so just be quiet. But all unenlightened beings share a delusion. They share a wrong view. They share something. We've got something very, very wrong about the nature of experience, the nature of consciousness, the nature of mind, the nature of everything that's going on. Yeah? We've got something very, very wrong. And you could say that enlightenment is when that view has totally, that wrong view has been totally seen through, and it's transformed every fibre of our being as a result. That would be perhaps one way of talking about what a Buddha is like, what a Buddha experiences. So would anybody like to have a guess at what this wrong view, this delusion, this fundamental delusion is? This fundamental thing that we've got wrong. Yes. Separation. Yeah, can you say more? You're on the right track, and I think that's a good way of starting. Separation.
And seeing yourself as a single entity in the universe.
Seeing yourself as a single entity in the universe.
Singular.
Yeah. Singular. Singular entity. That's right. So separation, seeing ourselves as a separate entity, a singular separate entity, existing apart from the rest of the universe, is one way of talking about that fundamental delusion. I'm going to explore other ways of talking as well. But I think this sense of having a separate self is very, very, very deeply ingrained in our minds, in our consciousness. Partly, I guess, because that's how common sense experience works. We have a body. My body is not your body, and yours is not mine. And they're separate, aren't they? And we can even extrapolate that to the mind. So my thoughts are not going to be your thoughts, at least most of the time. Like right now, I'm trying to articulate my thoughts, and maybe they'll influence your thoughts. Hopefully they will to some degree. But by and large, common sense would tell us that we're separate entities. Yeah? Any other ways of talking? So that's one way of talking about this wrong view. Any other ways of talking about this wrong view? Yes.
Maybe an expectation of permanence, of wanting to hang on to things, feelings, people.
That's right. So not only do we think that we are separate, but we assume that we'll last forever somewhere, and that also the world around us will last forever. Not at a rational level, because probably any adult, any thinking person would say, oh yeah, no, I know things don't last forever. But at a deep, sort of instinctive, emotional level, we haven't yet come to terms with the fact of change. At a deep, instinctive, emotional level. And the biggest change that probably we find difficult to come to terms with is that we will die, that we're mortal, and that everything around us will, well, everyone around us will die, that every being is mortal. Yeah. But impermanence, that fact of impermanence, or not seeing it truly as it is and assuming permanence, there's something else that's even more fundamental than that. And in a way, it's to do with this separation. One of the fundamental assumptions that we make is that there's a real objective world that I exist in and that you exist in. Yeah? That there's a real universe out there that's objective, independent of me. And then there's a real me somewhere in here, maybe in here, having the experience of this universe. Yeah? Does that feel... Do you recognise that view? Hopefully you do, because it's so deep-seated in us. It's so, so basic that probably we don't even think of it as an assumption. But it is an assumption. And from a Buddhist perspective, it's a delusion. It's a wrong assumption. We've got something very, very wrong when we think of a really existing objective universe and a really existing me, a subject in that universe. We've got something very, very wrong. Now, one of the reasons I think that view doesn't show itself more often is that it sort of works, doesn't it? It sort of works most of the time, I can live our everyday lives with this assumption of a real existing world and a really existing me, and get by. It sort of kind of works. And then what we try and do, based on this fundamental assumption, is that we try and arrange the universe, the world, so that it suits me. Yeah? So there's a real me in here, and I spend most of my life trying to arrange the world to suit me. Yeah? And one of the things that suits me is that just when I think I've got everything arranged, I want it to stay put. And of course, the fact of change, the fact of impermanence, says that no matter how much energy I spend arranging the universe, including other people and jobs and cars and whatever, no matter how much energy I expend, none of it is going to stay put. Yeah? So underlying this truth of impermanence, we've got this deep-seated assumption of objective reality out there and a real me in here. And that is the delusion that I want us to start challenging, tonight at least. One of the, I think, the sort of related, at least in our culture, one of the related kind of delusions that goes with this objective universe out there is a view of scientific materialism. And by that, what I mean is, not only do we think that there's an objective universe out there, but that objective universe out there is made of inert matter. That matter is primarily what there is. Stuff. And that stuff is somehow dead matter. And that our bodies are made of the same stuff as the rest of the universe. That matter is the primary reality. And then a commonplace view is that consciousness arises in the brain, because the brain is such a complex organ that all its billions of neurons, arranged as they are, conjure up this phenomenon that we call consciousness. So do you recognise that as a view, even if you don't hold it? It's quite a commonplace one, isn't it? That there is a real me and there's a real universe. And what's more, all of that is made of stuff. And that stuff, that matter, is the primary reality. And anything that I experience as mind or as consciousness arises out of my brain. So I'm a biological kind of machine. And that consciousness is a byproduct of brain chemistry. Yeah. The implication of that is that when we die, when the body dies, when the brain dies, consciousness stops. Yeah. That's the implication of that view. Does that view make sense to you, at least? Do you understand what I'm getting at? Now, Buddhism says, the Buddha said, that that was a fundamentally wrong view. That was a fundamentally wrong view. It's a view that in Buddhist philosophical terms is nihilism. It's nihilism. It's the notion that matter is all there is. And that when the body dies, the body is just matter, and that when it dies, consciousness stops. Yeah. Now that view is really common in our culture. I know not everybody will hold that view. Some people might hold a sort of another extreme view, as Buddhism would see it, which is that we have eternal souls, and that the body is just a vehicle for the real thing, which is some sort of immaterial soul, and that that soul is permanent and separate, and at the death of the body will be released and will live forever in some other realm. Does that view seem familiar as well? Yeah. And that view is seen as also a delusion, or a wrong view from a Buddhist perspective. It's called eternalism. Eternalism. That there's a real separate being in here, albeit an immaterial one, that will live forever. So I wonder if we can just do a quick poll and see if you had to classify yourself as primarily... I mean, actually, probably most of us at different times hold different views, and we're not logically consistent beings, sort of thankfully, probably. But we may have a sort of bias, a predominant bias towards... either the view that says I'm going to live forever and that there's a real immaterial soul somewhere, whatever, or soul might not be how you refer to it, but there's some sort of eternal aspect of me that will live forever. That's one extreme perspective. And the other extreme perspective is that the body is all there is. The body dies, the lights go out, and this life was... in a way, all there was, and we're just biological kind of machines. So I wonder if you'd be brave enough to see if we've got a predominance of one view or another. So perhaps just raise your hand if you are predominantly, most of the time, you think, sort of, if you think about it at all, in the eternalist camp of having some sort of fixed soul that will live forever. Yeah. Okay, and what about if you're in the other camp, that the bodies, once the lights go out, the body goes out, the lights go out. I'm sort of... No, actually, I'm not in that camp. And if you don't know... Yeah, so a few people who are agnostic. Okay. Okay, so thank you very much. So that was a few more for the nihilistic camp than the eternalistic camp, but actually not that many more. So that's quite interesting. So Buddhism says both of those views are extreme views, and they're trying to get at what's going on, but they're wrong. And because we've got them wrong... because we've got a wrong, fundamentally a wrong assumption, Buddhism sees that in a way is the root of all our suffering. So it's not just an academic argument of what do you believe? Oh, I believe this, you believe that. That's great, isn't it? We can live and let live. It's not like that. Buddhism says that if we get these assumptions fundamentally wrong, we cause ourselves and other people pain, yeah, and we remain in a state where consciousness doesn't unfold, not as fully as it can. Yeah? So instead, Buddhism has some other sense of what's going on. Before I move on to what Buddhism has to say, I just want to see if there are any questions from anything I've said so far about these fundamental assumptions or views. It's what?
Bit rigid.
What's a bit rigid?
Looking at eternalism on one side and nihilism on the other side. I mean, there's... Eternalism can sort of be
a map of pantheism. Eternalism could be... No, I think you might be onto something.
Yeah, eternalism can kind of sort of be a metaphor for...
Oh, yes.
Pantheistic
ideas. Yes.
You know, you've got kind of sort a literal interpretation of sort of deity based religions.
Yes.
And I think it can sort of shunt all the best religions over there.
Yes.
And make it seem as if Buddhism is sort of here.
Yeah.
And secularism is over there.
Yeah.
I think it can just it can make things seem across a bit rigid possibly.
Well, I think these two views are extremes, and then you might hold something slightly in between, although I don't know quite what that in between would look like. But in a way, without necessarily even evoking religion, all I'm talking about is, or secularism for that sake, all I'm talking about is what do we kind of believe about the nature of me? What do we hold instinctively about the nature of self, the nature of mind? And whatever we hold about that is going to determine how we live and how we act. And it seems to me that probably, mostly, we either can hold a sense that I exist even after the body's gone, in some sort of unchanged way, I'll live forever kind of thing, or that I won't. Do you see what I mean? And they're the two positions. But there is, of course, there is some, but out of those positions, then you can construct all sorts of belief systems, pantheism being one of them, or secular materialism being another one. You can construct all sorts of, sorry? Pantheism is believing that there's many, many gods. Yeah? But you can construct all sorts of belief systems. In a way, I'm not so bothered about what belief systems there are as what do we believe about ourselves. Yeah? So that's... And it feels like those two positions pretty much define at least two poles of what we might believe. Yeah. Yes.
I'm just thinking about that word wrong. It might be right, and it's the fact that we think like that that is making us unhappy. But it doesn't mean that it's wrong. That
I see. I see.
It's not the best way to think about it.
Yes.
You know what's right and what's wrong doing.
Yeah.
So what I see is they're proposing that there's a better way to think about it.
Yes.
What our own
say. Yes.
Not that's wrong. That's wrong.
It's
right.
Yes. So that's interesting, isn't it? What I think you're saying is that regardless of whether one is true or not, because that would be another way of talking about it, true or false. Regardless of what the truth is, there might be better or worse approaches to our life. So you're sort of saying that pragmatically, we could just be pragmatic and say it will make us happier if we follow this position. Yeah,
yeah.
So in a certain sense, I think that might be a fair enough starting point for a Buddhist to hold. Yeah. Because Buddhism doesn't ask you to have any sort of blind faith in something that you can't experience for yourself. And what Buddhism does say is that, after all views are they're approximations, that what's really going on, reality, can never be captured by concepts. So some approximations are more helpful than others. So I think that's a sort of valid, a pragmatic perspective is a valid approach. And you could just say, okay, well, I don't know what's going on. But if I assume this assumption, it's going to lead to greater happiness than not. Yeah? So that's a good way of thinking about it. So from that perspective, if we just... going to take a pragmatic perspective for now, or you could hold a pragmatic perspective. What then you could say is that the Buddha, what he was teaching is that if you hold a view that at the death of the body, everything ends, then that won't help you live your life in a way that will lead to fulfillment. And if you hold a view that you're going to live forever in some sort of fixed state, that's not going to help you lead your life.
Yeah.
So that, I think, is a valid perspective to have. But what I also want to say is that the Buddha did go further, and he did say, actually, these were false positions, and that the reason that they lead to unhappiness is because they don't accord with the way things are. So you don't have to agree with that, but I'm going to present what Buddhism has to say about the way things are, and then you can sort of, I don't know, make your own mind up, which is a thoroughly kind of Buddhist way of approaching any topic. You know, you kind of say, okay, well, what did the Buddha say? Does that make sense? Do I agree or not? Etc., etc. So I'm going to present what the Buddha broadly taught. And he said that, yeah, each of these is a false position on the way things are. Tom.
It might be a little unhelpful to ask this so early on.
Yes.
But I just wondered, in these two views, and I think it's very clear which one it gravitates towards, that there are some contemporary, supposedly Buddhist writers who veer quite strongly towards scientific materialism, who talk about brain science and talk about... I think it's a quote from Stephen Batchelor who says, you know, if you're curious about the nature of mind, well, maybe speak to a neuroscientist. Or, I mean, that's a bit crude, but basically indicating that these other ways of understanding mind have got an important truth to it. And I just wondered if you had any early reflections on what are they up to? Where does that fit in this?
I guess I can't comment on, I don't know what their position is necessarily or why they're holding that. All that I know is that wouldn't be the tradition. That wouldn't be the Buddhist tradition. The Buddhist tradition wouldn't ever say that at the death of the body there's no continuation of consciousness. Or that consciousness is merely a phenomenon of the brain. That's not the fire alarm. That's a burglar. So you can all relax. Yeah. So the tradition wouldn't say that, and I don't know why some Buddhists might say that, but that wouldn't be Buddhism as the tradition holds up. Yeah.
Is this kind of, maybe you're going to go on and say, sort of a grammar or a language thing, so that, thinking of impermanence, is it more of a kind of process?
Yeah.
And this is like binary code.
It is, yeah, it is.
And long, long time ago, when I did ancient Greek when I was at school, they have lots of words which are becoming words. Senescence and adolescence.
Yes.
Which hint that we're moving.
There's always a process. Yeah. I think that's right. I think our language can tend to binaries, is and is not, or exists and doesn't exist. And in a way, that doesn't help. That doesn't help us think about these things. But I'll maybe come on to language later on. But one of the things that I would say is that these assumptions that I'm talking about, I think, are pre-verbal. I think we're very, very, very instinctively conditioned to think of ourselves as an entity, as you were saying, a separate entity in an objective universe. That, to me, seems pre-verbal. And then this instinct about... This sort of sense of whether we're gonna, whether we identify with the body, or whether we think that there's something else, is maybe an acquired thing on top of that. But even that can go very, very deep. Yeah. So I want to just move on to say a little bit about the Buddhist position, at least from one perspective. And what Buddhism has to say is that we've just touched on it, that there are no fixed entities at all. There are no fixed entities either out there or in here. There's nothing fixed and separate. Well, I've brought in another concept there. Nothing is either fixed nor completely separate in a way that we might sort of commonsensically believe. So we're not a fixed and separate entity, and neither is anything in the universe out there. That what you have got is a flow of processes. And those flows of processes, none of them are entirely separate from other flows. There's no complete separation. So, for example, if you took a tree an everyday so-called object that we think of as existing out there, if you took a tree, it's very easy to think of it as an entity until you start to look at it from a chemical and a biological perspective. And then you know that actually it's a living process. It's a dynamic process that's always interacting with the air, with the light, with the earth, with water, with nutrients. It's always in flow. Yeah. Just now the leaves are just coming out, aren't they? And they're this glorious, vivid, bright green. A couple of weeks from now, they won't be. You can, at this time of year, sort of see the flow almost happening. And that's sort of something wonderful, isn't it? Something just happening. But Buddhism would say everything is like that. We think of this as much more static than a tree. But actually, it's just as, maybe not just as much, but it too is flow. So I studied physics when I was young, and physics would say if you did break this into its component parts and got smaller and smaller to an atomic level and then to a subatomic level, what you'd find is that those tiny subatomic particles were... there was nothing fixed and even solid about them. They were just manifestations of flowing energy that would arise and go out of existence. Yeah. Quite apart from the fact that we also know that, well, if I just do this, I've probably now got some subatomic particles of the bell on my hand, and vice versa. There's flow in that sense. Yeah. And also it is interacting, isn't it? This bowl is interacting with light. For example, there's light glinting off it. The sound that it makes is because it's interacting with the air around it, etc., etc. There's always interaction. It's not existing in some sort of vacuum, sealed way. So one of the things, yes, that Buddhism says is that everything is flowing and there is no fixed entities. There's no fixed entities. And that includes me and what I think of as me. But then there's something else that's perhaps a bit harder to understand, and this is what I want to try and talk about. It's that Buddhism says that this world that we sort of experience as existing out there doesn't really exist out there. That the world is mind-created, or at least our experience of the world is mind-created. Experiences are produced by mind. So we think of everything in the universe existing, apart from me, as objectively out there, independently of me. But what Buddhism says is no, each of us is creating this world of experience. So that's a bit harder to start to explore, but I'm going to give it a go. So see if I can hold up this lily. Try not to get pollen everywhere. So you've got a flower here, a lily. Rather sort of lovely thing. And what colours do you see in this? There's more than one colour, isn't there? What colours do you see?
Green, white, orange, red,
yeah, possibly. Green. Sorry?
Green.
Cream, yeah. Yellow, yeah. So if you just take a leaf there, it's predominantly green, isn't it? It's predominantly green. So that, from a common sense perspective, is sort of, that's all you need to say. You could, you know, if you wanted to leave it there and you wanted to describe its colour, you could say the leaf is green. But then, if you think about it a bit more closely, when you see a colour green, what's actually going on? What's going on? Yeah, light is reflecting off the object and we're perceiving it to be green. And that act of perception, we kind of know, is quite complicated. So light is entering into our eyes, and at the back of the eyes, in the retina, it's going to strike some light cones, which will then sort of fire off signals to the brain. And in the brain, in the actual sort of skull, no actual light has entered. In the brain, there's just these electrochemical signals. And the brain will interpret some of those signals as sensation of green. Yeah? The leaf isn't green. Do you see? That's just a real gross simplification to say the leaf is green. My experience of looking at this is I see green. But green is a sense perception. It's happening inside my mind in the end. Yeah? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So what colour is the leaf? Out there, actually.
Does it have no colour?
Well, indeed, even the notion of colour is a mind-made thing, isn't it? So if we dim the lights, exactly. So if we dim the lights, you wouldn't see it as green. If we shone a different light on it, it wouldn't necessarily appear as green. When you go out in the streets and there's neon lighting in the dark, all the colours are bleached, don't they? And they appear quite different to in daylight. So to say that there's an actual green leaf is a gross simplification of what's going on. Green is an experience in the mind. And yes, something of this leaf is producing that experience, but it's not like the colour is inherent in the thing. Colour doesn't exist as a thing like that. Yeah. No, let's stick with the leaf, because I've got more to say. I've got more to say. Let's stick with the leaf. So, the thing I've just talked about, the sense of colour, which is a sense of that arises through the eyes. It's a phenomenon, an experience that arises through the eyes. But if you take your other senses, taste and touch, well, let's take touch. So, you know, I can now touch this, and it feels it feels thin but solid, waxy, smooth, slightly rougher on the underside. But there's definitely a sensation between my fingers. Apart from when I think about it more deeply, again, that sensation of touch is nerve endings transmitting signals to the brain, and mind or consciousness or awareness having an experience that we call touch. You can sort of be misled by touch, can't you? Sometimes you can think that something's touching you. No, nothing is. It's just a sensation that can arise in meditation or something. Yeah. Something the mind can create sensations. So, for example, in meditation, I don't know if you've had this sense of a roving itch, where you scratch something there and then it moves on and there's an itch somewhere else. That's sometimes just mind made. There's nothing actually touching you, causing you to scratch. So that's what I'm trying to illustrate, is that our senses aren't accurate guides to what's out there. Yeah? They're not accurate guides to what's out there. Because our senses are particular sense organs, are unique to us. So, for example, if I was a fly, my looking at that leaf would be a very different experience. Yeah. So human beings have particular types of senses, and we experience the world as we do. If your eyes and my eyes could see into the infrared wavelength of light, we would probably see a huge sort of moving aura around the candle of red light. Yeah? But we can't see it. But that doesn't mean that it's no more there or no less there. Do you see what I mean? So our senses aren't reliable guides. So then what Buddhism says is that we can't really know through the senses or through concepts what's really going on out there. What's really there, we can't know through the senses or through our concepts. And Buddhism remains agnostic about what's out there. Yeah? It says, look, maybe there's something out there, but it remains completely agnostic about whether there is an out there or not. It just says we have experience. Yeah. So it undermines, just what I've said, starts to undermine this notion that there's an objectively existing world out there. Yeah. Are you with me so far? That's fairly straightforward, isn't it, to deal with the senses? Sort of fairly straightforward. I just want to drop in another couple of things, but I'm not going to have too much time to explore them. We might have to come back next week. One thing that I want to drop in is that not only does colour and sound and touch and taste and smell not exist out there, at least not completely independently of us, but what Buddhism or later Buddhism starts to say, or does say, is that space and time, this sort of framework within which experience happens are also mind-made. Yeah, that space and time are also mind-made. So not only do objects not exist as we think they do, but this whole framework of experience is a function of consciousness. I'm not going to go into that. I don't even know what that really means, apart from to say that from a Buddhist perspective, out there starts to lose all meaning. A thing that I can touch on a little bit that helps me at least understand or come to terms with some of this is modern physics. And quantum physics particularly starts to at least question whether there's an objective reality out there. Yeah? In quantum physics you get these weird behaviours, don't you? You've heard of waves and particles. Have you heard of the wave-particle duality? Of where an object can be both a wave and a particle. A particle can be a wave sometimes, and as a wave it sort of spreads out and flows, but it can also appear as a particle sometimes and then be in one place and behave like a solid object or a concentration of energy. And what quantum physics sort of shows is that whether an object like an electron manifests as a wave or a particle depends on the observer. Yeah? It depends on what you or I look for. If we're looking for a wave, we'll see a wave. If we're looking for a particle, it'll manifest as a particle. And the interpretation, or one interpretation of what's going on, is that when we're not looking, it's neither a wave nor a particle. Yeah? That it exists, if it exists at all, as potential wave, potential particle. But it only sort of, it doesn't even exist. It doesn't manifest until we look. It's just potentiality until we look. So that's really weird, isn't it? If that is true, and the best theories of physics say that that is what happens, if that's true of all the stuff that goes up to make, all the stuff that we think of as matter, then matter itself starts to be much more ghostly and weird than our common sense assumptions usually allow for. Yeah? Much, much more weird. So, what I'm trying to do is undermine or ask you to at least question common sense. A common sense view that there's real, an objective real universe out there and the real me in here. Undermine this notion that there are fixed entities at all. Undermine this notion that our senses tell us what the world is really like, because our senses can't really tell us what the world is like, and start to possibly explore that mind might make the world as we experience it, that consciousness really does shape, colour, give birth to experience. It's not just some passive observer. It's a participatory thing that's going on. And if that's true, and Buddhism would say it is, modern physics would say something like that, and common sense, even if you think about it, starts to say, oh yes, there's something like that going on. If that's true, then working with our minds really could transform the whole world, our world. Working with consciousness is the thing, the primary thing that there is. possibly. And certainly Buddhism says, from a pragmatic perspective, even if you think I've just talked a load of baloney, from a pragmatic perspective, working with our minds will lead to greater fulfillment. So just going to pause and see if there are any final questions. Yeah?
You talk about consciousness of the mind producing our experiences.
Yes.
Two questions, really. What type of consciousness does it have? Human consciousness, animal consciousness, and living consciousness? And the second question was, what if two minds, assuming they're separate, two people, have different perceptions, how does that resolve in creating sort of shared
reality? So I'm going to answer the first one quite quickly, and the second one I may not have time to, conveniently. the first one, Buddhism would say that human consciousness is only one type of consciousness. The animal consciousness is a different type of consciousness. And that actually what Buddhism would go further and say is that there is no inanimate matter at all. Everything, at some level or other, is conscious. Yeah? That the world is consciousness. Everything is consciousness. Matter is just a sort of solidification of the it's the external dimension of consciousness. Yeah. So everything is alive, albeit hopefully the glass isn't as conscious as I am. Hopefully I'm more conscious than the glass is. Yeah. So there are sort of perhaps grades of consciousness. Yeah. In terms of the shared reality, maybe it's to do with the fact that we all have the same sort of sense apparatus and the same brain chemistry. And so we will experience broadly things in a similar kind of way. But of course, if somebody was colorblind, that green might appear very different to them. And if you were a bat, if there was a bat in the room, a bat would be navigating through sound. It would be seeing through sound. And a bat's world would be a very different world to a human's world. Yeah? So it wouldn't, therefore, there'd be some overlap, but it's not completely a shared reality. So maybe we share a reality because of our senses and our common apparatus, as it were. I'm not going to answer that because I think there partly we're not going to have time. So maybe ask that next week. There is something really weird going on about if mind makes the world, how come we are in this shared world and that we can all agree about where the door is or something like that? Yeah. So there's something weird about that, and I'm not sure I kind of know, but we could try and explore it a little bit next week.